in that kind of like early blogosphere, which was like Simon Reynolds and Mark Fisher and all those guys.
How seriously should we take this Nick Land stuff?
You hear this all the time, this kind of nationalist thing or abundance, whatever. It's all flavors of a lot of the same critique, in my opinion, which is like, we don't build anything anymore. We need to start building again. What about America? We don't build anything. It's like, babe, we build a lot. We build a lot of data centers.
The Epstein files are hosted on Google Drive. Welcome to Doomscroll. I'm your host, Joshua Citarella. My guest is Liz Franczak, a co-host of the TrueAnon podcast.
In Freud's book on jokes and slips, he has this joke that is like, this guy's at a party and he works for some like millionaire. And he's like an assistant or like a shoe shiner or something or whatever.
Yeah,
but he
yeah.
really wants to like brag about his...
Low on the totem pole,
but he really wants to like brag about his relationship with this millionaire at this party. And he says, oh, well, you know, he treats me very familiarly. And everyone laughs. And the guy's really embarrassed. And it's this like, you know, for Freud, he's like, okay, well, this is something about the man's own humiliation. And he's trying to make a joke at his own expense, but he humiliates himself in the process. You know, it's like the very rich text, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And Lacan says, no. It's not just that. It's that this joke could only be made at this moment because it's at this moment that the family is being replaced by the millionaire. And so for him, it's this, in this text, it's this scene of the turn of the century when we've got the rise of the capitalist and the rise of the millionaire that is replacing this sort of older social form, right? And so he says that, you know, isn't this incredible that we have this ability to sort of say these things, you know, that we can understand something about history in this moment that history doesn't even understand about itself yet, right? And I'm gonna bring it to conspiracy, I promise. Which is that like, so I always think about conspiracies in a similar way, this sort of like displaced, deformed kind of narrative of us trying to grapple with something that we can't yet really make sense of. Jody Dean, actually, she has this great, from a while ago, she's talking about the moon landing, which is like my favorite conspiracy theory. Because I want it to be true so bad.
The oldest,
it's
the most
so
classic.
It's so great. Okay. It's so great. Like, oh my God. Can you imagine if like when the books are written about the American century, it's like we faked the moon. Like that is so perfect. You know, it's like, what does America do? It's like we make bombs. We make movies about bombs. And
movies about landing on the moon.
Yeah. And sure. like, so like the, you know, you write about the American century and it's like, well, we detonated the bomb and then we made a movie about how we did this great thing for humanity or whatever,
right,
but it wasn't
right.
real. I think that's so great. I would love it so much. But anyway, so see, I have a different kind of take on these things. But what she says about the moon landing is she says, well, you know, like the television presentation of the moon landing was integral to the entire project itself, because it was this massive propaganda push, right?
Sure,
obviously.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, it was about going to the moon and human achievement and ingenuity and so on and so forth. But it was really about like a show of force against the Soviets and broadcasting that with this nascent technology, this live broadcast technology to the world, right? It was a big show. And we know all of this. I mean, it's in the historical record, like all of the astronauts were handpicked for the, like with that in mind, and the way that the families were introduced to the public was like very carefully managed and packaged.
It's scripted, literally.
Literally.
Yeah.
And it was done by a group of men in suits. In a high rise, like on Madison Avenue.
Yeah.
You know, what do you want me to say?
Mad like, Men style TV production.
It was there.
Yeah.
It was a TV production. And so it is absolutely correct to say, actually, the moon landing is materially bound with the television production of it.
Yeah.
That's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think there's a way that we can understand that conspiracy as us trying to make sense of that relationship, that whole like architecture and narrative architecture, and not yet having the real language to do so yet. Does that make sense?
Is it maybe, if you bring this reading forward, is there an analogy to be drawn that the kind of contemporary resurgence of conspiracy is a way of kind of grappling with this insane media environment in which there is actually no trustworthy information?
I mean, I think that that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I don't know. I think some people in our orbit, our milieu, you know, there's a tendency to be like, or there's a very millennial tendency, we'll say, to talk about like the extremely online, as if it's this niche subculture, whatever.
It's a mass culture.
You know, every single person is 6'7". You know what I'm saying? Like, it's
right.
It's just, it is.
Yeah.
Everyone is online.
Right.
And everyone is extremely online in ways that I think are very difficult to make sense of.
So this is, I'm totally off script here, but maybe this is something worth cracking open. So we had this idea, my peer group starting to make art on the internet, that like that dichotomy I laid out before of like counterculture, oppositionality, being punk, being against status quo, that thing was an outmoded paradigm. And so the situation we're in now is that there's all different genres of identities that you can be a part of.
Yeah.
There's no particular incarnation of counterculture because there's nothing that's hegemonic right now. It's just like everything is its own siloed little niche and everyone's online all the time. And so our interpretation of that was that eventually, if you continue that process, if you run it forward and you atomize everybody into these cultural identities, the thing that is revealed at the end of it is their relationship to capital. That if you don't have the option to be like a punk or a mod or a skater or whatever, all these different genres of consumer identities that could be oppositional, the only opposition left is the real one that is underneath all of those cultural identities. That has been so catastrophically wrong. Now, like, everyone on the internet is like a conspiracy theorist who did not get closer to class consciousness. And it was a catastrophic mistake. But
and they're all entrepreneurs.
They're literally small business owners, doing drop shipping schemes.
Or anything. Gamblers or, I mean, I always talk about there's no real options left except for like the moonshot, which is either like getting famous through a host of websites from, I don't know, like OnlyFans to bum fights to whatever else we're going to come up with.
Fusion of those
Fusion of those with a token.
Oh, great.
And you could.
We're going to token. This is a huge opportunity.
It's huge.
We'll put a link in the bio for this, by the way.
Or, I mean, that's like a real cynical one. I'm sure people. Well, I don't think you can really get famous on Twitter anymore, actually. It used to be that, remember when they were giving people media jobs based on posting?
Oh, yeah.
It's different now.
That was a mistake.
But you can do that, or you can, you can try to get in on a meme coin, or you can, you know, predict whatever on Kalshi and hope that you just ride the wave.
Oh, my God.
That's it.
Yeah. I mean, to me, these prediction markets are, it's just crazy. So nihilistic, late stage empire, looting the public coffers. Maybe we could talk a little bit about how tech has structured our current economy. Because I think you're absolutely right to describing a lack of opportunity. Like the only things people have are to get famous as an influencer or get lucky on a crypto thing. And tech is seemingly like holding up the entire stock market right now. What is the influence of the tech sector on this current administration?
I don't want to fall in the trap of talking about Silicon Valley as if it's still the Obama years.
Yeah.
You know, when they were this sort of very contained ecosystem of like VC startup culture. Yeah. Like tech is less a standalone industry now than it is like an input for every other one.
You know what I mean?
Like it is how everything is coordinated and logistics you know, from the state to private businesses to everything else, you know what I mean? So it's, I have a hard time when I'm trying to sort of pull out what that, you know, quote unquote influence. It's like, are we talking about AI? Are we talking about crypto? Are we talking about like logistics, cloud service? Like it's so
housing
embedded,
ride transportation, ride shares,
absolutely,
agriculture even,
and every business is also it's layered into this stuff, right? Yeah. And so it's sort of like, I think when people are talking about the tech sector, what they're talking about is the kind of like Elon, you know, A16Z, Sand Hill Road. Does that still exist? I don't know. But, you know, like that kind of milieu. But I think it's also kind of important just to like draw that distinction to remind everyone that like we aren't living in that time anymore.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit.
I mean, I've heard this phrased in such a way that like tech basically, let's say it was a small enclave of like people who would make interesting websites like 20 years ago. But now basically what that means is people who decided to rewrite the laws and regulations of every other sector of the economy, that you would have a very difficult time kind of like rolling back the legislation for like taxi cabs, for example.
Right.
But if you built this lean competitive platform, you could just rewrite, instantiate a new set of laws in the code of that platform. So tech generally is just capital now. It's capital rewriting the laws of every market they want to participate in. And that extends to, agriculture, transportation, housing, everything. Is there some kind of conflict here with the nationalist constituency in the Trump admin versus this tech sector? Like their interests are at odds in some places?
It's hard for me to understand how much is just theater and how much is like a real conflict, I guess. You know, oh, there's this big split between like libertarians and nationalists or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, I don't really see it as that. I don't think they're that ideologically committed. I think maybe they play it like that on the internet for whatever points they get. Or, you know, and probably believe some of it too. But I think like the real kind of deeper contradictions within the Trump coalition, but also generally like within the sort of American political landscape, class landscape, are a lot of these ideas about like reshoring, which is, in my opinion, a fantasy, a productive fantasy because it gets you votes.
Sure.
And that's why every party likes to trot it out every 4 years. But, you know, the global system is so hardwired in so many ways that you can't just like rebuild a Chinese supply chain in Ohio for vibes. Like it doesn't, you know, like it doesn't make sense. And this goes to like, you know, a lot of people's critiques about, you hear this all the time, this kind of nationalist thing or abundance, whatever. It's all flavors of a lot of the same critique, in my opinion, which is like, we don't build anything anymore. We need to start building again. What about America? We don't build anything. It's like, babe, we build a lot. We build a lot of data centers.
Sure.
We build what is profitable, which is right now data centers and whatever else is a sink for trillions of in capital expenditures, which is not factories and is not housing. Like is not, that's just not what is profitable in America right now. You know, so that's another role that tech plays, right? It's a really great sink for what is an asset-based economy, right? That we live in.
On this topic of reshoring, this used to be a question that was discussed a lot more on the left. There's different camps of what that will mean economically. And you and I are familiar with what I thought was a more widely known or discussed niche corner of left politics. But there was a certain group of people who interpreted that reshoring as creating the incentives for automation and then kind of building a politics out of that. This is a camp called accelerationism, which is maybe in today's internet the most bastardized word that exists and has been used to mean a dozen million different things.
Sure.
Some of these visions from the right, in particular, Marc Andreessen has written many different manifestos. Do we have a clear idea of what this kind of tech accelerationist vision for the American economy is going to look like?
You're right about accelerationism being this bastardized term. It's so funny that it like keeps coming back. I don't know if you feel that way.
I thought it was done in 2015, and then here we are 10 years later.
Should we
just define like what is accelerationism?
Yeah.
And what the hell should we interpret that to mean now?
My like broad, let's say a very broad, generous, non-ideological.
Okay. The non-ideological one. Yeah.
Is okay. That I think it's like not really like a coherent doctrine.
Yeah.
So much as like a family of different beliefs that are all based on kind of like a very, I don't know if it felt at the time, but I think definitely now is sort of like a set of very like banal observations, which is that like modern capitalism and modern technology are moving at faster and faster speeds to the point that the institutions that we have are potentially too slow to continue to govern them.
Right.
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 In the way that they are shaped now.
So literally, I mean, that would be a lot of these like tech platforms that came up in like the 20 teens.
Yeah.
And then basically like rewrote the law. They couldn't be governed by the institutions we had. Like, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I think, you know, to be fair, like it does split off in many different ways. Like,
oh, there's a whole alphabet of different accelerationisms.
Like, but from that. I mean, I do think that is kind of just
which is the good one?
Which is the good one?
How about not the good one? What's your favorite?
We can put that behind the paywall.
Yeah, okay. And then we'll reveal what the best accelerationism is.
No, but I mean, I think the classic left-right split is like the easy one. We don't need to get into like U or whatever, which is the kind
People
of more
will
umbrella.
Make up
it wasn't
any,
called. It wasn't umbrella accelerationism, but that would be
just
pretty good.
Lump them all in together.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the right-wing version, obviously, which is kind of what you're talking about with the tech companies, is like, and this is a good thing, you know? I mean, that's the kind of simple way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And we should, you know, basically get out of the way and let this process continue to evolve and strip away any kind of democratic drag on, you know, we should actively try to speed this up. And then, you know, that can get into like the more psychedelic versions of that sentiment, which is the kind of like Nick Land.
Yeah.
This is a, you know, capital as a sort of alien superintelligence.
Right.
The left-wing version of it was, yes, this is happening, but also rather than trying to stop it, we should work to reorient it toward a more humane and a more just and a more socialized future, right? Yeah. Which is kind of the thing you were talking about with all these conversations about reshoring and automation and what kind of potential futures that might hold. Back in the day when everyone was having these conversations on the internet, you know, I think a lot of that was towards a sort of like post-work, post-austerity vision for what, you know, the future could hold. And that was the sort of like left-wing take on that. I mean, I'm doing this with very broad strokes. Kinda.
It's good to kind of like sketch this out. And I guess this was the underlying topic that I was interested to discuss with you today.
Yeah.
But to kind of set up a little bit of a lineage here, you have the kind of K-punk extended universe. You've got Mark Fisher with this idea of capitalist realism that 2008, there's the clear failure of this system, but there's no alternative that comes up.
Yeah.
And so people, I think, in some cases correctly identify an uninterrupted downward trend for 40 years that no matter what the left does, protest, organize, whatever, it can't seem to stem the tide of privatization, of techno-accelerationism, of whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, they start thinking about, well, what is an alternative politics that I can propose that looks for opportunities within this ever-increasing acceleration of capital that might provide, you know, something for the left? And so, yeah, that reshoring and automation, it's like, well, what if we all own the robots? You start to come up with proposals like this.
Yeah.
The great irony, though, is that once that material gets published around 2015, right on the heels of it is social democracy again, where you had Sanders and Corbyn, and all of a sudden, like, that kind of, right, you know, almost like a decade of kind of theorizing these things is put on the back burner because, okay, to rekindle the political imagination on the left, we just needed social democracy the whole time.
Right, right.
So I feel like I was pretty convinced about that. But now, after, you know, two Trump administrations, 10 plus years later, I'm not totally convinced that we are still playing social democracy versus neoliberalism anymore.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of curious to maybe bring in some of those old conversations from left accelerationism, just because I see all of the different hurdles that, social democracy ran up against in the last 10 years. So are there pieces of that ecosystem, of that theory, that you find useful for today?
You brought up Fisher, and I think that actually, you know, he was really focused on critiquing what he saw as a kind of nostalgic politics.
Yeah.
And that some of that had to do with, you mentioned capitalist realism, his other ideas about hauntology, that there was this sort of, we're all kind of haunted by these futures that never arrive, and that it would, you know, it showed up in all these different ways in the culture, and it's kind of like, yeah, nostalgic politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for the left accelerationists, like, a lot of that at the time came out of a real rejection of a kind of like small scale folk politics that felt that it wasn't dealing with the world as it is.
Can we define folk politics for people who don't know?
I mean, people are going to get mad at me. I think they were really critiquing a kind of like focus on local, focus on small, focus on like co-ops and
mutual aid, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, some of this stuff feels more like conversations we keep having, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
But it was kind of coming out of that, and it was sort of an insistence like, no, you have to actually look at how the world is right now, which is that we live in this very globally interconnected, highly technologically advanced society, and retreating into these older forms is a way of sort of escaping, trying to sidestep some of these more difficult political conversations. Now, and I feel like Fisher really, that was a big focus of his,
yeah,
or it's something that always like stuck with me, and I think that's still incredibly relevant, the folk politics thing. But you know, you bring up the Sanders Corbyn moment and this kind of like push for social democracy kind of stuff. I mean, I think that one of the big contradictions that a lot of in America, right, that a lot of left-wing politics runs up against is that we live in a highly advanced and very wealthy country.
Yeah.
Very, very wealthy country where the middle class and the upper middle class are highly politicized.
Mm-hmm.
And also their wealth is asset-based. So it's tied up in the market in a way that makes a kind of politics that would fund a sort of like social democratic welfareism very difficult, right?
Yeah.
Like it's funny because it's the same, this is the same kind of contradiction that a lot of the abundance people run into. Mm-hmm. Right? I actually was curious your thoughts on this stuff. But they want to fund all of these big projects They want to kind of get all of this stuff done. But if you were to push for a kind of Chinese style reinvestment, right?
Oh, don't mind if I do. Okay.
Yeah, right. Sorry. A reinvestment with Chinese characteristics.
Nice.
But if you were, right, yeah. Rather than it going into the market, rather than it kind of propping up corporate profits yeah. and, you know, or stock buybacks and, you know, all these beautiful American things that we love to do.
Yeah.
If you were to do that, it would blow a hole in the class that both parties depend on for their votes.
Right.
It would blow a
right.
huge hole in the balance sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be, you know, no one wants to see a radicalized, I don't know, 45-year-old who just lost half their 401k
yeah.
and their child's
yeah, yeah.
college fund and their mm-hmm. real estate portfolio, whatever, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is real political concerns.
A middle class that's just been disappropriated is very politically dangerous.
Yeah. And I think that, like, again, this is a contradiction at the heart of the American political economy that the sorts of like nostalgia politics that Fisher and all these guys were critiquing, like, they are really good at getting votes.
Mm-hmm.
They're really
mm-hmm.
good at like mobilizing. And then when it comes to governing, and you see this on the right now too.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's much more complicated.
Yeah.
And there's many more contradictions there at the heart. And so I think the insistence of, you know, saying like, no, we need to actually have an accurate read on mm-hmm. the situation mm-hmm. in this moment
yeah.
and not
yeah.
fall back into mm-hmm. romanticizing these older forms is incredibly important. I think that's really important.
Yeah, that's been, I'm showing my cards a little bit here,
yeah.
but like that has been kind of the crosshairs that I've focused in on for this show, where like a lot of the explorations we've done of this techno-libertarian world, I think has to be framed out by like the techno-libertarian right has this kind of image of the future, right? They talk about it all the time. They make these dumb AI images of it, but like there is something as terrible as it might be that is being proposed. And then the left project right now is to kind of try and get back to the 1970s.
Yeah.
And so I think that maybe one of the reasons that we're losing is not just because of the structural asymmetry of who has access to what resources and so on, but is also because the vision we're proposing is not scaling exactly to the crisis that we're dealing with now. Where if you look at these, we had David Adler here to talk about Prospera this morning, but—
Has he been there?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
For, I mean, years before.
Oh, okay.
he and I have had dinner and talked about this at length for a long time, but the kind of economic patchwork of capital flight that is set up now was basically designed by the neoliberals to drain the potential for social democracy from any of these countries.
Mm.
And so we are charging up a difficult hill that is only now steeper in 2025 than it was in 1970. And so I'm just finding these two kind of sets of knowledge of like what it takes to do social democracy and what the techno-libertarians are trying to do to the rest of society. And they're basically non-overlapping spheres. And you are maybe one of the few people who's in my political corner who's familiar with some of this stuff. And I guess what I keep going back to is like, maybe it's time to revisit some of those proposals from accelerationism specifically to add to the policy portfolio for the left now.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, as you know, just like you said, we can win these elections, but then the damage that is done to the movement when we make big promises and then it is not possible to govern that way sets
yeah.
us back even further each time.
I mean, it's funny because I still feel that like looping time. I really like feel that like stuckness, even as all of this stuff is actually on the march.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny. It feels very different than even as all of these technical or techno shifts are happening very quickly, increasingly quickly. And all of this sort of news and everything, all these information systems and communication systems have rapidly developed and turned very schizophrenic, in that time period.
Yeah, yeah.
I still feel like very kind of everything feels very stagnant to me. And so that sort of critique, I still very much, that was very influential on me, I think. So that sticks with me.
To watch part two of this episode, you can support the show on Patreon. What is the structure of this new economy currently?
Right now, we live in a system that is sort of developed out of the way that capitalism rewired itself after the 1970s, which is kind of the moment you're talking about. We're talking about
after deindustrialization.
Deindustrialization, which kind of started. People always talk about it like it started in the 90s, which is very weird. But it's really kind of a late 60s, early 70s story. There's another thing that kind of happened, which I think is maybe what you're getting at with the tech stuff, that's important to talk about in the context of the U.S., which is that, you know, so we had, Silicon Valley has always had like an important development role starting from the 80s and 90s, you know, because it was always tied up in DARPA and it was working on these larger sort of infrastructure initiatives, whatever. But then we fast forward to the 2000s, you know, after the dot-com bust, when they start kind of becoming these like growth stocks, these like kind of bigger sort of exciting dynamic companies, and you know, the internet takes on this sort of like second wave, whatever. Cut to 2014, 2015. So I'm like jumping around the whole place, but I'm trying to tell this story a little bit. There's sort of two big events that shift a lot of how global capital is moving. There's the OPEC crisis in 2014 and then the Chinese monetary regime shift in 2015. And what that does is a lot of capital rotates out of specific markets and is looking for sort of safe havens with decent yields and ends up pouring into this very narrow band of U.S. equities, which is the tech companies. And it's at that point they go from kind of growth stocks to this quasi-reserve asset moment. And so they're sort of guaranteeing a lot of demand for U.S. dollars at the same time that they're anchoring all the indices. So it's they have a kind of dual role there. Now, on the other side of that, the U.S., the state is like starts to work with them much more closely on massive infrastructure projects. And by that, I mean...
Is that data or is that
all of it. Think about every agency that runs on cloud, private cloud computing, or all of our public communications that are on private
Amtrak
platforms, you know, yes, DHS, CIA, NSA, they're all still there. And yet they're all kind of running on private data, mass private data collection services, you know what I mean? And so there's a way in which a lot of state planning and operations, it's not just contracted out, it's like fully fused into these companies. And so they're both at one, they're like at once like a kind of monetary ballast for the US system and the sort of operating infrastructure of the state. Like it's a very, I think that's like less appreciated when we're trying to kind of track how influential these companies are, because it's sort of like, it's less, I think, about who's having dinner at Mar-a-Lago and more sort of structurally the position that these companies have, which we can say Mag 7 or whatever, however we want to like catch all these firms. You know, I think that that is like maybe a bit more important to kind of like dig into.
Yeah, I think you put this very succinctly in a recent live show, that it does strike me as odd that the Epstein files are hosted on Google Drive. Like, shouldn't, like, this is the government we're talking about here.
Thank you.
You know, like, shouldn't we have our own hosting service?
I mean,
like, there's some kind of dynamic where in a previous functional model, you would assume that, like, Google would rent resources from the state, that the state would be getting some kind of revenue from this. But instead, it's like, yeah, we're literally just mailing out a Google Drive link to the press.
It's so budget, isn't it? Like, it's so...
Like, we can afford it, right?
I'm like, wait a second, is this like a like group project?
We
like,
also what rent server space from AWS, too.
Of course.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's all... I mean, but this was also, like, you know, part of the big, you know, we call it doggy, doge, whatever project.
Yeah.
Trying to get a lot of these systems up to date, mm-hmm. these federal mm-hmm. systems,
yeah.
with Palantir contracts and, yeah, you know, yeah. these like enterprise systems. Yeah. And so, you know, I think that this is, it's a bigger story.
The last thing that I want to explore here is the shift from that period to now. Within the kind of worldview or espoused ideology of tech.
Mm-hmm.
If you roll back the clock to, let's say, like 2012 or so, there's a lot of rhetoric about like libertarian exit mm-hmm. and them trying to like escape what they called the paper belt, which was like DC regulating them
they
through laws.
They called that the paper
yeah,
belt?
Yeah, it was a Balaji phrase.
That's bad.
We need to escape the paper belt.
That poor guy.
I mean, it doesn't seem like it's going. So the fire festival he's got going over there in Malaysia or whatever.
Yeah, that's a tough one for him.
Some people have made this like pretty big pivot.
Yeah.
Andreessen, I'm not going to remember the essay off the top of my head, but he said something to the effect of like, rather than a capital strike, the real like Atlas move would be to just take over the society.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what they're doing now.
Yeah.
So... how should we understand this shift from like the 10 years ago rhetoric of techno-libertarian exit
yeah.
to this national coalition, national conservative coalition, which is now literally part of the military-industrial complex,
yeah.
is patrolling the border, is constructing Palantir, which will be the new surveillance state. Like,
yeah.
how did they make that complete 180 within the last 10 years?
Well, I mean, it's a lot easier to say, like, I'm going to leave the state when the money's cheap and the state's doing great. You know what I'm saying? Like, uh-huh. it's a lot easier to, like, plan an exit when interest rates are real low and you're flush with funny money.
It was
ZIRP. And you can kind of just be like, well, what if we just lived on a boat? Like, that is, although uh-huh. Patry Friedman was in the FT this weekend, or like last
oh,
week,
yeah?
did you see?
What it, for what?
Like, about exit.
Oh,
and I was like,
he's
this
still
man
doing
is
it?
Committed.
Oh my God, leave it alone, man. Come on.
You know what? I say get out there on those high seas.
Yeah.
You get out there.
Push him out slowly.
Yeah. And then we just like let him go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Float on, my friend. Mm. Float on, my brother. No. So I do think that backdrop is like important
mm-hmm.
because obviously things change when suddenly money is a bit more expensive
mm-hmm.
and yeah. government contracts are very lucrative.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Oh, and, yeah.
And also at the same time, a lot of the tech evolves and we're moving from, you know, you see these big tech companies hitting a kind of plateau with the platformization of everything.
Yeah.
And yeah. sort of the, you know, the pivot into quote unquote hard tech, which is, I mean, let's be real, it's drones. It's
yeah.
like what we're
right,
talking
right.
about.
Yeah.
It's drones and no, but it's also, it's a data collection and all of that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole sort, you know, whole host of other things, but that makes a lot more sense when you're mm-hmm. looking to shore up investment and more and capital. And so I do think that that is like kind of an essential part of this.
Yeah.
Rather
yeah.
than there being some sort of, I mean, who knows what they say to themselves or whatever, but rather than there being some sort of very clear, like ideological awakening.
Mm-hmm.
everything has changed, but like everything is very different than this kind of Web 2.0 era.
Yeah.
When, you know, a lot of that stuff could be entertained a little bit more.
I mean, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I'm going to rephrase, make sure I'm following you on this. So rather than attributing that influence to like the intellectuals of the movement, what we saw was low interest rates, access to lots of really cheap venture capital, and then basically elaborate pitches with like no limitations on them. It's like, oh yeah, we started a company, let's start a country, like this kind of thing. And then when the money dried up and the government is the one writing the checks, all of a sudden they're like, actually, we've been planning to spy on a whole bunch of people. Do you want to pay for that? Like that is actually the pivot. And then their intellectuals espouse this new ideology to facilitate where the money is coming from. And actually, that's the kind of origin point.
I think I don't know if it's that cut and dry, but I just think that as we're trying to figure out the shift in orientation, that's an important part of that story. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think that there was like shifts in the culture and shifts in the, maybe in the stuff that they're reading and the way that they're starting to think about the world.
Sure,
all of that stuff is important as well, as is, you know, again, like platforms hitting a kind of limit in what could be.
They saturated the market.
Absolutely. And how, you know, as a service, kind of, again, maybe hitting its like rent limits and that shifting, you know, a lot of the ways in which people start looking for profit. I mean, so all of this is part of the story as much as it's like, you know, everyone got like super nationalist or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, I just think that, you know, I'm always trying to just like shade things a little bit.
Yeah, I found myself wondering, and I'm paraphrasing something that you said at the live show. This is maybe a month or two back now, but there was some trajectory from this exitarian project that they tried. I mean, they tried to build the seasteads, right? They like tried to build them. They couldn't get something that could withstand like the 20-foot waves on the open ocean. Mm-hmm. They tried to do it on a cruise ship. They've tried to like buy land and have their private city states. Like those things didn't work.
Yeah.
And so the strategy that they just retreated to is like, actually, it's way more cost efficient to just buy parts of the state. And so they started integrating themselves into the state apparatus, found ways to privatize the old public functions. And I found myself thinking, like, basically the argument that you were making is that they have, in effect, captured the state by becoming the only like growth asset in our economy, which is that the way they manage their companies now literally holds up the entirety of the U.S. stock market.
Yeah.
And so the decisions that they make are kind of granted by the government. The funds come from the government. And so they never needed to exit or go outside the state. They could just take it over from within. Yeah. And we are basically now being held hostage by the demands of these companies as they privatize every aspect of our society, deprive us of democratic rights, and extract rents for us to pay for it. So,
yeah.
Congratulations.
They did it.
They did it. They did it. Wow. We should, however, address the real source of power in Silicon Valley. What is the gay mafia?
This goes back to the cabal thing, doesn't it? Who are you talking about? Are you talking about Thiel? Are you talking about, what's his name? Sam Altman? Who else is gay?
I think we need
to find out. Who else is gay? That's
violently
what I'm always asking.
Out all the founders. Yeah.
Hey, are you gay?
Is there some kind of like debt peonage scheme to like get found investors for you? That was not what I meant, but I suppose so.
There's a slip.
Yep. That was the Freudian slip. Yeah. Okay. But this last serious question is we've talked about a lot of really abstract concepts. There's a wealth of different material to explore. If you could recommend one or a few books that got you inspired to start looking into these topics, what are some things that first come to mind?
I mean, we talked so much about Fisher that I'm like, get that huge K-Punk book. I don't know. I think the blog posts are just so great. And so people, first of all, people don't blog anymore. I don't care about what these Substackers are saying. That is not blogging.
It's not the same.
It's not the same. Everything was so off the cuff. Everything was so casual. And also in the comments, and there was just like a kind of robust little community that feels that can't exist anymore because of the sort of professionalization of a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
But we were talking about that, and so I feel like I should recommend that.
That's a pretty good one.
Okay.
Yeah. Liz Franczak, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm just a huge fan of your work, and it's wonderful to have you here today.
Thanks so much. This is fun.
To watch part two of this episode, you can support the show on Patreon.